Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 10th of February 2023 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. We are currently concentrating on British history, particularly the Saxon period, with the rather wonderful king, Alfred the Great. And this is our third episode devoted to Alfred the Great. And of course, I do have with me my two co-hosts, Truthvids from truthvids.net and the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Truthvids, how are you doing, sir? How's your website doing?
Yeah, all great, thanks. For the first time, I gave in and just decided to set up some cryptocurrency addresses. Thanks to your encouragement. So I've now got it on the main site, Bitcoin, Monero, and I can't even, Ethereum, right? See, I'm still all new to it. But yeah, if people want to donate to the 100 Proofs projects, and hopefully I can turn it into a book as well one day, then they're welcome to support me. So yeah, thanks for the suggestions, Sven.
Yeah, well, I think it's worth it having a little donations button there. If people like your work, they like to be able to say thank you in some way. And that's a way that people can say thank you. They can contribute towards the running costs, basically. Obviously, you got server space and the time that you put into running truthvids.net and making all these videos. And I mean, obviously, you'll be paying for it yourself. So if somebody sends you something that refunds you, maybe it gives you enough money to go to the cinema, take your wife out, you know, have a drink for an evening, give yourself a tip. And I think the consumers of our content, they like to be able to do things like that for us, particularly if they've seen something or they've listened to something that they particularly like. And also it encourages more people to use cryptocurrency, which takes us out of the usury banking system, doesn't it? And keeps us separate from that. Patriarch, welcome back to the show. How are you doing? How is the Patriotic Arts Community?
Hi Sven. Yeah, thanks for having me back. It's all going well. Got a few things in the pipeline. We're going to have start up the contests again, and I think we've got a top secret project coming up as well, a top secret animation project, which should be good. Another encouragement for people to support Truthvids and his work. Obviously, things take time, a lot of time and effort. And if, there's one way that people can really just support is just through, things like crypto. And it really makes a big difference to the creators of, people trying to, put good work out and for the cause, really. So, yeah.
And we should also remind people if they're musicians or they're poets or they're artists, then they should join the Patriotic Arts Community, where you will find other artists who will help out with your work, review it, give you tips. I often pop in there and check out the art. Wave guy's on there. He's one of the most particularly busiest artists I think that we have. He seems to put out new work every day. So check out Patriotic Arts Community on Telegram, and also check out truthvids.net on the web. Well, let's get into what we're going to be talking about today then. Just before then, I have a couple of corrections to make from the last episode. I was talking about Ugarit with reference to the Finns and the Ugaritic language, which is where the Finnish language comes from. And I mistakenly said that Ugarit is the place where people first spoke English. And what I meant to say is Ugarit is one of the places where we find some of the earliest writing in the world. So I got writing mixed up with English, because we normally write in English, I guess. And the second mistake that I made was when I was talking about Danegeld, and I said that when Alfred the Great made his treaty with Guthrum, they accepted that if a Dane was injured, the Danes would be paid some money. And if the Saxons were injured, the Danes would pay the Saxons some money. And I said that it was Wargeld that was the Saxon money and Danegeld was the money that was paid to the Danes. And that was wrong. Danegeld is actually, that was a penny paid on every oxide by the Saxons to the Danes. And that was a long time after Alfred the Great, when the Danes had actually taken over the country. And that might have been when the Patriarch was referring to when the Danes were still pagan, when they had more of the country. And I think that took place after Alfred the Great. But the word Danegeld, it sounds similar to Wergeld, because it has that geld bit at the end of it. Wergeld was for injuries, and Danegeld was just money that was specifically paid to the Danes. So two corrections. that I wanted to make there first before we start getting into this. And in the last episode, we were talking about the Navy. We were talking about Alfred's Navy that he had built up and how the ships that he built were so much larger than the Viking vessels. So we'll continue with our notes here now. And the notes come from Wikipedia for this part. Alfred had sea power in mind. If he could intercept raiding fleets before they landed, he could spare his kingdom from being ravaged. Alfred's ships may have been superior in conception, but in practice they actually proved to be too large to manoeuvre well in the close waters of estuaries and rivers, the only places in which a naval battle could be fought. The warships of the time were not designed to be ship killers, but rather troop carriers. It has been suggested that, like sea battles in late Viking Age Scandinavia, these battles may have entailed a ship coming alongside an opposing vessel, lashing the two ships together and then boarding the craft. The result was a land battle involving hand-to-hand fighting on board the two lashed vessels. And in the last episode, we were saying that where these ships were so much bigger, they were seaworthy ships, and they could be larger than the Viking ones, because the Viking ship that needed to get across the English Channel, so obviously needed to be a large size, but it also needed to be small enough so they could get up the estuaries and the rivers. So they were limited there. They couldn't build a ship specifically for the sea, and they couldn't build a ship specifically for the rivers if they were the Vikings or the Danes. Whereas the Saxons, they could build a ship specifically for the sea if they wanted to get them at sea, or they could build them for the rivers if they wanted to get them in the rivers. And I guess Alfred's idea was to make one for the sea, make it of a certain size, a large size. And in the one recorded naval engagement in 896, Alfred's new fleet of 9 ships intercepted 6 Viking ships at the mouth of an unidentified river in the south of England, and the Danes had beached half their ships and gone inland. Alfred's ships immediately moved to block their escape. The 3 Viking ships that were afloat attempted to break through the English lines, but only one of them made it, and Alfred's ships intercepted the other 2. Lashing the Viking boats to their own, the English crew boarded and proceeded to kill the Vikings. One ship escaped because Alfred's heavy ships became grounded when the tide went out, though. A land battle then ensued between the 2 crews. The Danes were heavily outnumbered, but as the tide rose, they returned to their boats, which with shallower drafts were freed first. The English watched as the Vikings rowed past them, but they suffered so many casualties, 120 dead against 62 Frisians and English, that they had difficulty in putting out to sea. All were too damaged to row around Sussex, and 2 were driven against the Sussex coast, possibly at Selsey Bill. The shipwrecked crew were then brought before Alfred at Winchester and hanged. So we have quite a lot of detail here showing how they fought. I should imagine once they'd actually slaughtered the other crew or captured them, then they could take the ship inland as well, and they would also have a Viking ship there for themselves, which so they wouldn't just take out the crew, but they'd also end up with new technology there or new boats that they were able to get from this. Any thoughts on this, Truefids?
Yeah. Firstly, I just wanted to say that were is the Germanic word for man, right? So weregild just means man money, how much you have to pay if you injured that man. And then they even had different prices, right? If it was a peasant or a lord or a king, you'd have to pay more, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And the word world, it's 2 words. It's were, man, and eld, which means age. So it actually means the age of man. So originally, world didn't mean a geographical location. It just meant the era of, you know, the Germanic tribes. That was the world. That's how they viewed it. And it's only now, once we've explored the whole world, we start to see it as a geographical place. So it just shows you how the views have changed. And when you read ancient history, you have to view it through their eyes when they're writing something, not with our modern ways. But back to this ship battle, that's a pretty fascinating battle. So when the tide goes out, you know, if you're standing on the beach, suddenly you get all this landmass. So if the boats were there, they would suddenly, you know, be grounded, and they'd have to jump off the ships and then fight a land battle. And then as the tide came back in, they could jump back on the boats, and some managed to escape, right? So that's a pretty, you know, extraordinary battle, not your common battle. And with the hooking, usually that the Romans did this as well, you'd throw like a hook and then reel it in. And if you weren't prepared for this, you know, you could build this great wooden stick with like a scythe to cut the rope. But if you weren't prepared, you wouldn't have one of those ready. So basically you were doomed. You'd get reeled in and there was nothing you could do but just try and win the fight and then sail away, right?
Yeah, you can just imagine it, can't you? That you got the grappling hook and that's put over the side of the boat and it's pulling. I mean, you're never going to be able to pull that off, are you? But I should imagine people did have a knife nearby. And that's a good point that you bring up there about the world. And we should remember that whenever we're reading old texts, looking in the Bible, even when it talks about the world, it just means the known world to them, which could, in depending on the context, I mean, it could just be the valley that the group that were writing the records actually lived in. It didn't mean the whole world, including Africa, China, India, Asia, that the whole world that we know today. It was just literally the world that they knew. You have to remember that, like, a world is really an imaginative world. It's the world within the mind. It's the world that you know. It's a world of ideas, not necessarily meaning the planet. So it's just the inhabited world. I mean, the Romans were talking about the inhabited world, the civilized world, and outside of that were the barbarians. Patriarch, any thoughts on Alfred's navy and the naval battle here?
Yeah, just to add to the concept of the world, I mean, there's plenty of examples in the Bible where it talks about the gospel has been preached to the whole world already, and that gives an insight of what they classed as the world. And also, Caesar went out to tax the whole world, it says in the Bible. So, you know, we do really have to be very careful with, you know, how doctrines and how we understand, you know, things like the Bible and different doctrines come from the assumptions that we add the meaning to these words, such as the whole world. You know, now it's got to be that the whole world has to be Christian, for example. but that aside, it's a fascinating battle, really. And I just wonder how beneficial the capturing of some of the boats were in terms of understanding the strengths, the weaknesses, you know, from it's almost like being able to reverse engineer. And it's just a bit of information and added insight they'd have on the enemy, right?
Yeah, it must have helped them to capture these other boats, and it must have been interesting to them to see that where they had a shallower I don't know what the word is, the gauge between the gunwales and the base of the ship, the hull, where that was shallower, they were able to navigate more. So maybe they thought about that with the next vessels that they built. But it shows that, you know, his ideas for building these vessels, they weren't you know, they weren't too bad in actual fact, because they managed to block off the escape route for them with these vessels, which was a new idea, I guess. Well, next up, I want to quote from Asser's Life of King Alfred about Alfred the man himself. And Asser says, he titles it Alfred's Varied Pursuits. In the meantime, the king, during the wars and frequent trammels of this present life, the invasions of the heathen, and his own daily infirmities of body, continued to carry on the government and to practice hunting in all its branches, to give instruction to his goldsmiths and all his artificers, his falconers, hawkers, and dog keepers, to build houses majestic and rich beyond all custom of his predecessors, after his own new designs, to recite the Saxon books, and especially to learn by heart Saxon poems, and to make others learn them, he alone never ceasing from studying most diligently to the best of his ability. And I'll just stop there, because we talked in the last episode about how once they actually had peace, they'd made peace with Guthrum, Alfred went out and searched out people that could actually teach the Saxons how to do all these things. And he obviously must have been there learning alongside them. And he was giving instruction to them, to the metal workers, to the carpenters. And it says here that he built some fantastic houses. And that was all to his own designs. And obviously he also built these burgs that we were talking about. these fenced enclosures where the people could run to if they happened to see the Saxons, and they were all within a day's reach of these other burgs or the nearest burg nearby, so the army could get there. He also had a standing army, so he had loads of ideas. I mean, I guess these are the secular ideas, because he also had religious ideas that we'll get to in a bit. And it also tells you the sort of things that they considered to be important. Hunting is the first one that's mentioned there. You know, it was important to be able to hunt. And he says he practiced hunting in all of its branches: falconers, hawkers, dog keepers, and encouraging all his artificers, which were, you know, metalwork, glasswork, woodwork. And it was a real golden age, basically, for the Saxons. It was the first time they'd actually had an age like this, I think. Certainly in the history that they had in Britain. Perhaps they might have had an earlier one under Charlemagne in France, but he was really part of the Franks by then. So I guess this was the first golden age of the Saxons would have been under King Alfred, I think. Anyway, truth is, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, again, it just shows you what Christianity is all about. It's about loving your own people, right? This was a Saxon community, and just like Charlemagne had a Frank people, you know, a kingdom of the Franks, it's all about cooperating and loving your own people. It is not like the modern version, which has been twisted into accepting, you know, all types of immigrants and giving them free houses and all that. That's what people think Christianity is about now, and sending off, you know, all of our wealth to other countries. It was nothing like that. This is what it's truly like. Just like if you have your own family, you know, the parents look after their children and raise them. Well, in a wider community, this is what it should be like. Everybody looking after each other and cooperating, and you'll get a great civilization, right?
Yeah, that's the way that the king should look on the nation, as a father would look on his family. I also find it interesting. He says here, you know, reciting the Saxon books, because they didn't really have books up to this point. So these were books that he had managed to write, translate from Latin into Saxon, because he had translators there that were doing this, including him. And he says, and especially to learn by heart. So they had good memories then. So they were learning to write and to read things from where it had been written down on the parchment, but they were also learning to memorize things and to recite from memory, which was the way that the Druids did things. And as we said before, the way that the Hebrews used to do things, I think that was a part of the ancient world, was memorizing things completely. And you know, today we couldn't even remember our phone books that we used to remember just 20 years ago. We all used to remember the whole contents of our phone book. And we can't do that now. Patriarch, any thoughts on this flowering of civilization here in England?
Kind of reminds me of... you know, when his mother told him to read and memorize these books, and he's kind of just following in his mother's footsteps, and how trying to nurture, you know, his citizens as his mother helped to nurture him. So he's kind of just passing that forward, isn't he? Because he understands, you know, the strength and wisdom and, you know, kind of information and knowledge, wealth of knowledge from our ancestors. It's important. I also wonder though why the Saxons weren't so literate in the first place. Is it, you think they're just because they were kind of hands-on nomadic people for so long?
Well, I think there's a part of that they were nomadic for a long time. You think the language that they had was probably runes, which were sort of cut into wood rather than put down in parchment. And also the Danes had been attacking for the last century or whatever, and the excuse that's written in Asser's Life of Alfred, I think it is, or the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, it says that because of all these attacks of the Danes, there was nobody in Alfred's kingdom that could read or write. And he says that it's because of these Viking attacks. But others say, like, as you pointed out there, that the Saxons were nomads. This is why when some people talk about the Saxons before this period, they'll say, well, they were pretty much barbarians. You know, they were great fighters, but they didn't have any literature to speak of. So there are two reasons there, because they were just fighters, and also because these attacks by the Danes. And if we trace them back, as we have done, to the Scythians, and then trace them back to the Israelites that were in captivity, they lost all of their civilization. So they had the ability to build a civilization, but they lost all the trappings of it, made their way into Europe as the Scythians, got to Germany, and by that time the word had become Saxon, and then they made their way into England. So they were constantly on the move as well. So you wouldn't have had much time to write literature when you're, you know, when you're constantly on the move and you're attacking people, you're being an army for hire. So you just wouldn't have had the time to do these things. And that's what was so important here now, was that because there was this peace with Guthrum, Alfred was able to do all of this. And as we pointed out, he also was highly religious. He daily attended mass and the other services of religion. He recited certain psalms together with prayers and the daily and nightly hour service, and frequented the churches at night, as I have said, that he might pray in secret apart from the others. He bestowed alms and largesses both on natives and on foreigners of all countries, was most affable and agreeable to all, and was skilful in the investigation of things unknown. Many Franks, Frisians, Gauls, heathen, Welsh, Irish, and Bretons, noble and simple, submitted voluntarily to his dominion, and all of them, according to their worthiness, he ruled, loved, honoured, and enriched with money and power as if they had been his own people. So there, when he says he's bestowing all upon on foreigners of all countries, you can see there it was countries close to him. It was basically people descended from the Scythians, people descended from the Cimmerians. I mean, very, very close in ethnicity to him. He's not bestowing this upon Muslims from Arabia or anything like that. It's on people that are part of the same race. Moreover, he was sedulous and zealous in the habit of hearing the divine scriptures read by his own countrymen. Or if by any chance it so happened that anyone arrived from abroad, to hear prayers in company with foreigners. His bishops too, and all the clergy, his eldermen and nobles, his personal attendants and friends, he loved with wonderful affection. Their sons too, who were bred up in the royal household, were no less dear to him than his own, and he never ceased to instruct them in all kinds of good morals, and among other things, himself to teach them literature night and day. So you can see here, I mean, he set up a school basically, and that was for the people that were the most bright. It wasn't just for the nobles, it was for the peasants as well. You can see here how religion is so important to him here, and how people would arrive from abroad, and you'd have these embassies and diplomats that would arrive, and people wanted to be a part of his kingdom. I mean, the Welsh went to him, and some of the Irish did as well. And he was ruling all of these people because he was such a good king, and they wanted to all be a part of this. Truefids, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I was just going to say, as for the Saxon poems, firstly, that they did have like these ancient tales that people could recite, like Beowulf, and eventually in this era, they must have started to write them down. And you know, that's why there's probably a few different versions, but so there was Saxon tales, but for the first time they could start actually writing them. And you know, that's why there isn't that many Saxon tales, because they just, whatever they remembered, they managed to keep. And yeah, back to Alfred, you know, if the Welsh or the, you know, the former Britons who are constantly at war with the Anglo-Saxons now willingly are willing to accept him as king, it must show you that Alfred must be a great man, because they hated the Anglo-Saxons, and it would only be if he was a good Christian king, because the Welsh were a Christian for a long time at this point, at least several centuries, right? And you know, that's why. And also when Edward, Alfred's son, took over, there was a letter I read that he left to Edward, you know, with instructions on how to run the kingdom. And one thing that struck me was that he said, remember the poor, look after the poor. You know, because that was one of the commandments the apostles and Christ gave. So it shows you he really did read the gospel, and he believed in it, and that he wanted, you know, the English and basically the people of the British Isles to be looked after, not only, you know, the nobles and friends, but also the common people.
Well, it was incumbent upon the nobles that they had to help the people that were less well off than themselves. And it was like, that's what those people are there for, so that the nobles can engage in charity. And when you're helping out your own people, when they say charity begins at home, it's like that wealth is going to your own people to help them build themselves up. And once they build themselves up, their wealth will then go back into the system again. So it stays within the system. If you're helping out people from another people group, you're giving your wealth to them, then when they get themselves on top, their wealth goes into their people group rather than to the people group that where the charity started. That's why it says in the Bible, cast your bread upon the waters so that it may come back to you. And that's talking about charity beginning at home. And one of the problems we have today is the great and the good will look at this period and they'll say, oh, look, he welcomed all these foreigners in and he helped them out and he gave them, you know, charity. But they missed the fact that these were all very, very closely related peoples that he was doing this to. And they were closely related ethnicities. They're all part of his extended family. What we have today is we have people that are coming in from all over the world, and we pay for their medical care. We give them the benefits. We give them all of these things. And instead of this going back into our system, if they earn any wealth on top, that gets sent back to these other countries. It gets sent back to these other people groups. So it doesn't stay within our own people group. Now, that's before you even get into the other problems that mass immigration has caused. Patriarch, any thoughts on this description of Alfred's kingdom here?
Yeah, I'd love to live in a period like that, wouldn't you? I mean,
oh yeah,
it just shows you the height of or the strength of Christianity compared to paganism. I think that different peoples will be willing to hand over the sovereignty of their own nation to be under a new ruler, and I think it just goes to show that when you live by the standards of through Christianity, how infectious it is and how it binds people together, you know, obviously kindred peoples together. And it's as God intended. And Alfred is clearly the greatest example of that and his kingdom.
Yeah, I think it's a nationalist message as well, isn't it? You know, doing your best for your people, trying to be the best example of your ethnic group that you can be. And he saw that it was very, very important for him that he set a good example for everyone. He was the king. He was the one that everybody would follow, that they would look to set this example. So it was very important for him to show that he had good morals. But as if he had no consolation in all of these things, and suffered no other annoyance either from within or without, he was so harassed by daily and nightly sadness that he complained and made moan to the Lord and to all who were admitted to his familiarity and affection that Almighty God had made him ignorant of divine wisdom and of the liberal arts. In this, emulating the pious, famous and wealthy Solomon, king of the Hebrews, who at the outset, despising all present glory and riches, asked wisdom of God, and yet found both, namely wisdom and present glory, as it is written, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you." But God, who is always the observer of the thoughts of the inward mind, the instigator of all meditations and of all good purposes, and a plentiful aider in the formation of good desires, for he would never inspire a man to aim at the good, unless he also amply supplied that which the man justly and properly wished to have, stirred up the king's mind from within, not from without, as it is written, "I will hearken to what the Lord God will say concerning me." He would avail himself of every opportunity to procure assistance in his good designs, to aid him in his strivings after wisdom, that he might attain to what he aimed at, and like a prudent bee, which rising in summer at early morning from her beloved cells, steers her course with rapid flight along the uncertain paths of the air, and descends on the manifold and varied flowers of grasses, herbs and shrubs, essaying that which most pleases her, and bearing it home, he directed the eyes of his mind afar, and sought that which without which he had not within, that is, in his own kingdom. And then after that, Alfred then amasses a group of learned men from Wales, Mercia, and as far afield as Gaul, including Asser, the author, from Wales. So this is the period where he invites in all these great, intelligent people so that he can try to learn from them. And one of the things he used to do, he used to have people reading aloud to him while he was doing other things. And when I can remember when I was first reading that, it made me think, you know, we're so lucky today that we can have podcasts and we can learn things, we can hear other people talking, we can have audiobooks while we're doing other things. And the only way that you could really do that back then is if you were a king. And the king could have somebody reading out the Consolations of Philosophy or reading out something written by Justinian or one of the ancient classical Greeks. And he could have somebody reading that out aloud to him while he was doing other things. So he could learn like that. You know, we forget that we're so lucky today to have all these things, the advent of radio, television, the internet. And really, it was just the royalty back then that could learn all these things. And you can see here, Asser, he likes to make this analogy with the bee. He uses that quite a few times. I think the bee was obviously quite important to them back then for some reason. I think I've even seen images of a bee that go back to Solomon's time and in the pyramids. There's something about the bee they saw as imparting some information to man. Perhaps it was the way that the hive was set up with the different cells, with all the bees working together, with one bee in charge. Not quite sure, but it has a link with wisdom as well, which is why he's pointing this out here. Truefids, any thoughts about this?
Yeah, firstly, back to what you said about wealth and charity. Today we're all deceived into always investing into complete junk, right? That, oh, you have to have this huge pension and you know, have you thought about investing in this stock or this stock? And then 20, 30 years later, it all collapses and disappears, right? And it turns out it was a scam. And, you know, whereas in the past, people used to think, well, I've got some wealth, I'll put it towards something public, like a library, or, you know, I'll build something in my town that will last forever, and I'll give it to my people, or you know, I'll build a park, or you know, just donate it so that it's something for the people, rather than always thinking, oh, you know, I could double my wealth in 10 years or quadruple it. You know, we're trained our people to only think that way now, right? And I'm not quite sure about the bee thing. I think bees, that they all cooperate. Every bee, you know, they never stop working. Bees fertilize, you know, basically that the entire land, right? That the flowers, that the crops, you know, everything relies on bees. And they work marvelously together, right? In harmonies. And they're always building these colonies. So perhaps if you look at bees, you realize, well, if I make this great, you know, nation, kingdom of everyone cooperating, I can, you know, basically build a great nation just like bees. That's what I imagine people would look at, the, you know, cooperation. And of course, Christian civilization is the best form of that. It's basically the most efficient way where we all work together, right?
Yeah, I think there are representations of the bee that were linked with the Merovingians as well. Perhaps it is this working thing where they're able to build the beehive and they all work together. And you also think about that, you know, how could something like the bee evolve? You know, it's needed for absolutely everything. You know, it could only have appeared at the same time as everything else, because it's so intimately connected with everything, and it wouldn't be able to function without you know, without the flowers to pollinate. And where does it get this idea to do everything from? You know, obviously that idea, that order, the way that everything functions together, the system that existed first, you know, but before the system manifested itself so that we could interact with it, you know, it must have appeared in the mind of God. But that's getting off into philosophy there. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
I was just thinking the servants reading out them books would have been quite lucky themselves, wouldn't they? I'm sure they wouldn't really have access to a lot of that. A lot of the kind of the books that Alfred gets to listen to, you know, educating themselves as a job, really, to read them aloud.
Yeah, that must have been really useful for them. I hadn't thought of that, actually. You know, the other people that would be hearing this, just the servants themselves, that they would be hearing you know, the equivalent of Radio 4 or today's modern podcasts. So I've got a little quote here about when he was doing this. Again, this is from Asser's Life of King Alfred. "When therefore I had come to him at the royal villa called Leonaford, I was honourably received by him and remained that time with him at his court for 8 months, during which I read to him whatever books he liked, of such as he had at hand, for this is his peculiar and most confirmed habit, both night and day, amidst all his other occupations of mind and body, either himself to read books or to listen to the reading of others. And it must have been after he was taught to read that he would read books for himself, and he would also actually translate books from Latin into Old English. And obviously he would listen to people as well. And what Asser did when Alfred the Great asked him to come to his court and to basically teach people and teach people what he did, Asser said that, well, he would come there for, I think it was 8 months, 6 months at a time, and then he'd go back to Wales for 6 months at a time because he couldn't leave his, you know, his people in Wales. So he showed, you know, his support for his ethnicity there as well. Next, we'll move back to Wikipedia and we'll look at some of his legal reforms, because he was very well known for reforming the legal system and for writing his own law codes. In the late 880s or the early 890s, Alfred issued a long doom book or law code consisting of his own laws, followed by a code issued by his late 7th century predecessor, King Inni of Wessex. Together, these laws are arranged into 120 chapters. In his introduction, Alfred explains that he gathered together the laws he found in many synod books, so religious books, and ordered to be written many of the ones that our forefathers observed, those that pleased me, and many of the ones that did not please me I rejected, with the advice of my counsellors, and commanded them to be observed in a different way. So he improved upon the law code, and I think he would have used as well for this, he would have used the laws, the Molmutine laws, the ancient Britain laws, British laws that we had, Breton law as well. And Alfred singled out in particular the laws that he found in the days of Inne, my kinsman, or Offa, king of the Mercians, or King Ethelbert of Kent, who first among the English people received baptism. So we have mention again there of Offa, who also set up a royal mint and didn't have usury. So he was an important king, so he also collected laws together. And Alfred appended rather than integrated the laws of Inne into his code. And although he included, as had Ethelbert, a scale of payments in compensation for injuries to various body parts, the two injury tariffs are not quite aligned. Offa is not known to have issued a law code, leading historian Patrick Warmold to speculate that Alfred had in mind the Legatine Capitulary of 786 that was presented to Offa by the papal legate George of Ostia. But, you know, it could have been Offa, couldn't it? Because he did set up a royal mint, didn't he? I mean, he was setting up currency. And I think to do that, you have to have some legal instrument of some kind in order to actually set up a bank. Any thoughts on this, Truefids?
Yeah, I mean, your law code generally depends on your kingdom surviving, right? And that it gets instituted and then people can write about it. And obviously the Mercian kingdom kind of got overrun by the Danes. So perhaps whatever Offa had, maybe lots of it got lost, right? And also I forgot to mention earlier that where you said he was reading Solomon, it shows you that the books of Solomon were originally in the Bible. They were part of the Bible. They were originally in the King James, but eventually it got removed for whatever reason, or moved to the Apocrypha, right? But it shows you that the kings did look at that for obviously wisdom, as wisdom of Solomon, and to teach them how to reign as a king, right? And yeah, I think Alfred would have also looked at the original laws by Brutus and, you know, previous kings. But here he could, because he could really read the Bible, he could update it and improve it with, you know, the Christian commandments. And of course, Christ said, if you love me, keep my commandments. That would be the commandments in the Exodus, the Ten Commandments, but also all the later ones, right? No sodomy, no fornication, all that is mentioned later in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. That would of course be included, so you know, you could write it into a great book. And this is where I believe we got the common law. The main thing about the common law is, because it's based on the Bible, It basically tells you what you are not allowed to do. So basically you're free, but just don't break these laws. Whilst I think, I could be wrong, but I believe Napoleon started to change it where he had his empire. He did it the other way around. He wrote a new law where it tells you what you're allowed to do. So basically, that the Anglo-Saxon way, which is more closely, you know, the common law based on the Bible, it only tells you what you're not allowed to do. But apart from that, you're free to do anything. But Napoleon's way is, it tells you what you're allowed to do. So basically you're not allowed to do anything unless the government tells you. And that's what most modern laws are kind of going, right, based that way, where it's becoming more and more tyrannical.
I think that might even go back before Napoleon, because, you know, if you look at these old historians and ancient patriots from 1800, 1900, they would talk about how important our laws were and how they were different. They were based on liberty. And what they meant by that is exactly what you were just explaining there, Truefids. And I think they go back to saying that that was actually Roman law, and our common law goes back to that time, and it's based on liberty, you know, not telling you what you can do, but just telling you what you can't do. And it gets built on and it expands throughout time. Common law, based on what happens within the courts, that determines the way that it evolves, basically. But yeah, it's a completely different type of law to the laws that are on the continent. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, that was an interesting point that Truefids mentioned. And, you know, I think the beginnings of liberalism kind of emerged, didn't they, with in the French Revolution and Napoleon, it seemed that anyway to me. And so with the almost an inversion of, you know, instead of saying what you can't do, to say what you can do, it actually seems supposed to be more liberating is actually more controlling, and I guess it is kind of similar to like that, similar today. But I had a quick look at what the word synod is, and it's rooted to the Greek synodas, and it's assembly, isn't it? So, and they're all these kind of books are very linked to early church, early church assemblies of instruction, I think. So again, it goes to show that he was really trying to branch out and instill Christian ethics into society at a deep rooted level.
Yeah, that's what these synods were about. They were about deciding what, you know, exactly what the Bible was telling us and what the Christian instruction should be. And they would have like all the various bishops there, all the important people, and they would just decide these things. So Alfred's saying that this law book is based entirely on Christian instruction. I mean, it's so central to our civilization that these Christian laws that people today would try and say, oh, you know, we'll just forget about all of that. But it's essential to everything, you know, and the pagans didn't come up with these ideas. It was only once we had Christianity that we had all of this. About a fifth of the law code is taken up by Alfred's introduction, which includes translations into English of the Ten Commandments, a few chapters from the book of Exodus, and the apostolic letter from the Acts of the Apostles. The introduction may best be understood as Alfred's meditation upon the meaning of Christian law. It traces the continuity between God's gift of law to Moses on to Alfred's own issuance of law to the West Saxon people. By doing so, it linked the holy past to the historical present and represented Alfred's law giving as a type of divine legislation. So he had the old Ten Commandments there, which talks about not coveting thy neighbor's ass in one commandment, and then the other commandment it says to not adulterate, and meaning not to mix things together, not to dilute things, rather than not to commit adultery, because otherwise you've got two commandments that are saying the same thing. So where it's talking about to not adulterate, it means to dilute, to fornicate, to mix races, basically, was the original interpretation, I think, of it. Otherwise, you've got two commandments, which are saying exactly the same thing. So that would have been in there. And I think the bit from the book of Exodus that he's talked about there, it might well be the bit where it's talking about the Jubilee, and how every 40 years all debts were supposed to be absolved and there's no usury. So he obviously he took Christianity very, very important. And the Old Testament, I mean, it sets out a way to have society. That's why Jesus didn't really refer to it much, not because it's all been superseded, but because that has already been set out, you know, the correct way that society should be run. That's what those laws are there for. It's very political. And if the Israelites had followed all of these laws, they would have had a perfect society. And it was an ethnostate, and it was all based around their ethnicity. So I say, you know, it was very, very nationalist. Truefids, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, just to what you were saying earlier about the synod, that a synagogue is actually a Greek word, isn't it? It just means the meeting place where people meet. That's all it was. I believe even Plato used that, right? And it's because we come from the Germanic tribes and we were kind of separate from the Greek and Roman, you know, people. We had our own culture, and the Germanic tribe was kirk for where you meet, and it evolved into church. So that's why we say church rather than synagogue for a meeting place. But people are deceived into thinking it's, you know, an old Hebrew word, but it's not. It's a Greek word. It's never used in the Old Testament. But what you said about adultery, that's completely true. You know, you adulterate the blood. That's what it is, right? That you shouldn't mix. That was one of the key commandments. And that's why it seems strange that he says, don't commit adultery, and then don't, you know, look at another man's wife. Well, why would he tell you to do the same thing twice? And adultery is one of the top few commandments, right? Because it's really important. Honor God, honor your parents, and don't commit adultery, right? Because it's all about preserving the Israelite bloodline.
Well, yeah, when you look at honor your father and your mother, I mean, the question then is, well, which father and which mother? Because you've got all these fathers and mothers going all the way back. So the answer is, well, you have to honor all of them. How do you honor all of your ancestors? Well, you marry somebody who looks like you, and you produce another one who looks exactly the same as all of your ancestors. You know, that's what that means. So, you know, not just that there was this do not adulterate, but just honor your father and your mother is saying the same thing there. It was so important. It's so important, basically, to ancient society that the Israelites did this. That's why I say it's an ethnostate. And Christianity, I think, is very similar to nationalism, particularly with the commandment that Jesus gave, which was to love your neighbor as yourself. And what he's doing there is quoting from a verse in Leviticus, which defines what the word neighbor means. And it means the children of your people. So it means the children of your ethnicity, your ethnic group. Love the people in your ethnic group as you love yourself. And everything else is built upon that. And if you're doing that, then you are worshipping God. You are serving God. That's how you serve God, is by loving your ethnic group. You know, it's very open when you read it, but the churches won't interpret it that way. They'll try and tell you that your neighbor just means whoever lives next door to you. Doesn't matter if they're African, Chinese, Indian. That's what it means. And that's not what the original scriptures are telling us. And Jesus was quoting from that. Very essential to everything was ethnicity. And Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah. Obviously, just touching on some of the points, I mean, kind after kind, isn't it, really? And even when you look in Genesis, you know, God made man, Adam, in his own image. And then it goes on to say about, and Adam begot Seth in his own image and likeness. So I really, you know, regardless of what denomination of Christianity you're into or accept, and some of the fundamental things are there, you know, and you know, just plain as day, you know, I mean, it's just a godly thing, isn't it, to procreate in your own image and reflection. It's there from the very beginning. And the word for bastard, for example, you know, for some reason, we just assume that it's an out of wedlock kind of child. I mean, it's quite bizarre, but you'd easily use the word to bastardize and understand that that is to, you know, it's the same as adulterate, isn't it? It's to deteriorate, to dilute.
Yeah, the word bastard, it comes from the Hebrew word mamzer, which is a mixed race individual. What you brought up there as well was the kind after kind, which was the first commandment, basically, was kind after kind. I think it said something like 10 times in the first or second chapter of Genesis. God creates everything kind after kind, each within its own kind. And then in chapter 6, you get the sons of the gods go in and take wives of the daughters of men. And that's not kind after kind, is it? And the result of that is all this chaos, death, destruction on the world and the confusing of all the kinds and the flood. You know, there was only one law that was given at the beginning, kind after kind, and yet that law was broken. And the end result of that was the flood. Yeah, it's a theme that runs throughout the whole Bible. Also, you get these laws that the Hebrews were supposed to obey, not sowing two different types of seed within one field, not putting two different types of food together in the larder, not wearing two different types of cloth, cotton and wool. You know, they weren't to blend anything or to adulterate anything. It's very, very, very important. And then it finds its expression later on in the covenant with Isaac and then with Jacob. And they had to marry people from within their own people group. They could only marry Hebrews. That's why. Go on.
They were instructed to kill all the Canaanites, weren't they? And it was their sort of unwillingness to do that which led them to kind of worshipping foreign gods and intermixing. So that's kind of pretty much the most based sort of instruction that you can get, really.
Well, it also shows you know, how serious it was taken back then. And obviously, as you said, the Israelites didn't do that, and they intermingled with them, and because of that, they lost their country. And it's like a morality tale, isn't it? You know, if you don't have an ethno-state and you intermingle with all these other peoples, then you will lose everything. You know, that's the message that it gives. But yeah, it goes all the way back, and obviously Alfred was, you know, including the commandments, because he knew that they were so important, and there's this aspect to them which is just ignored by the modern churches. Getting back here, similarly, Alfred divided his code into 120 chapters, because 120 was the age at which Moses died, and in the number symbolism of early medieval Bible exegetes, 120 stood for law. The link between Mosaic law and Alfred's code is the apostolic letter, which explained that Christ had come not to shatter or annul the commandments, but to fulfill them. And he taught mercy and meekness. The mercy that Christ infused into Mosaic law underlies the injury tariffs that figure so prominently in barbarian law codes since Christian synods established through that mercy which Christ taught, that for almost every misdeed at the first offence, secular lords might, with their permission, receive without sin the monetary compensation which they then fixed. So that was the origin of this idea that you would pay a fine rather than like an eye for an eye, leave the world eyeless and toothless or whatever the saying is. You would have fines that would be paid for this. And what it's saying here is that even the barbarians copied this, because it was such a sensible idea. And it was basically applying mercy, and the mercy that was shown through Christ, and applying that to these law codes. The only crime that could not be compensated for with a payment of money was treachery to a lord. Since Almighty God adjudged none for those who despised him, nor did Christ, the Son of God, adjudge any for the one who betrayed him to death. And he commanded everyone to love his Lord as himself. Alfred's transformation of Christ's commandment from love your neighbour as yourself to love your secular Lord as you would love the Lord Christ himself underscores the importance that Alfred placed upon lordship, which he understood as a sacred bond instituted by God for the governance of men. And that is the system that was set up in the Bible. It's a monarchy that was set up, and even that was supposed to be imperfect, but that was the one that was actually set up here. And what he's saying here is about an oath. If you break your oath to your Lord, to the monarchy or the one who is above you, then that's a serious crime, very serious crime. I mean, it doesn't mention it here, but the importance of keeping your oaths is very much stressed in Alfred's Law Code, I remember from when I last had a look at it. Truefids, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, originally there was no kings. You had the judges period for 400 years. And whenever the Israelites sinned, you know, they started going off into paganism, God would basically allow the neighboring countries to come in and ravage them until they repented. And this was like a continuous punishment, because, you know, you might get a good generation and then their kid, their, you know, the next generation, not so good. And then you get a bad generation, and it would correct them, and it would always make sure that they stayed godly. And that's why they demanded a king, because they thought, well, hang on, we can get out of this, because if we have a king, he'll just go conquer all the surrounding nations and we can just do what we want. And that's why we have kings today. And that's why God said, don't have a king, because you're going to end up being tyrannized, right? And you see now that the lords basically rule over them. And that was basically instituted part, you know, as a punishment, but also just the way things are. And of course, eventually it would all crumble so that Christ could return as the true king and reign over us in a truly godly kingdom when he returned. So it was a punishment, but it was also evidently part of God's plan, because he knew that we would go that way. But as for Alfred's, you know, making sure that people kept their oath, he had to have that in the society so that there was no treason and scheming and treachery. And he was also known for executing lords, or, you know, judges, anyone who was a bad lord or who accepted a bribe. You know, he did ensure that the lords kept in line. So he hoped that they would keep it a good, goodly society, right?
Yeah, he used to sit in on the judges' hearings, on the trials. I mean, we'll get into that next week as well. Petra, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, just on the subject of kingship, obviously, you know, I think we ultimately need a leader. It's just whether the leader is going to be benevolent and rule with God, which is essentially where Israel as a name derived from, isn't it? If you're not going to rule with God, then it's going to be tyrannical. It's going to be a corrupt society, and, you know, it's not going to ferment the kingdom of heaven.
Well, I think also the Saxons had this idea of the divine right to rule, and we've talked about this before, that this, you know, this right to rule goes back to Judah, basically, and that family line, and that was the reason why these kings had the right to rule. And when they did rule, they had to obey God, and what they were in their position for was to ensure that God's laws were kept within the kingdom. And it's similar in a way to what it says about how the woman is to rule over the children, and she is to obey her husband, and the husband is to rule over the wife, and the husband is to obey the laws of God. And so it's the man that is to obey the laws of God. And I think it's a similar thing here with the king. He's the one that ensures that the laws of God are kept within the kingdom. And if they're all kept as they were supposed to be kept, you know, you would have no usury within the kingdom. Every 50 years, everything would go back to the lands of your family. You know, your family would own all those lands again. That there was none of this idea that every time the land was passed on, there would be inheritance tax until it was all owned by the state. And you do have this problem with the kings, as you were pointing out there, Truefids. And it says, I think God says to them when they want to have a king, if you have a king, he will amass horses to himself. He will amass wealth to himself. But at the same time, as we have learned, the king would actually lead the people into battle. So the king was taking these risks, and these kings would sometimes die in battle as well. So I guess they would say, well, look, you've got me as the figurehead. I lead you into war, and I've got this divine right to rule. So, you know, you should pay me taxes so that I can organize these things. Well, Alfred's Law Code should be understood not as a legal manual, but as an ideological manifesto of kingship, designed more for symbolic impact than for practical direction, it says. And that's a quote there. In practical terms, the most important law in the Law Code may well have been the first. We enjoin what is most necessary, that each man keep carefully his oath and his pledge, which expresses a fundamental tenet of Anglo-Saxon law. Again, this is very interesting because this came in with Christianity, because we know that the Saxons broke their oath, didn't they, on the night of the Long Knives, and they killed all the Welsh princes. They had a love day, they had a peace parley, basically, and the Saxons went there and they kept knives hidden in their ankle boots, and you're supposed to put all your weapons to one side as you go through the circle, into the circle, the stone circle, I guess. And they didn't. They kept the knives in their ankles, and then at the word, which was something like, "Now let us talk of peace and love," they pulled out the knives and they slaughtered all the Welsh princes, and that's the original Knight of the Long Knives. So they broke their oath there, and that was 300 years before this. So now they've become Christian, and oaths are absolutely central, that they keep their oaths. And if you think about it today, everything is based upon people keeping their oaths to serve. And before we had liberalism and humanism and gave people this idea that God doesn't exist, people were God-fearing, and they thought, if I break my oath, there's going to be damnation in hell. I'm going to be damned for all eternity for breaking my oath. So people kept their oath. And yet still today, people take these oaths. But where there isn't the fear of God anymore, it's like people are not too frightened to break their oath anymore, are they? And yet the whole of society is based on it. You know, from the judges to the police to the solicitors, to the army, all the instruments of power, all these different sections of society, these important people, they all take an oath. And back then, you know, when you had the fear of God in people, they would keep their oaths. But today, I think now that they don't teach people to believe in God, and atheism is the same, then, you know, who's going to punish you if you break your oath? So I think that, you know, that it's like, it's basically taken apart our whole society by saying that people can be atheists and not instilling the fear of God into them, because the oath is so central to everything. Any thoughts on this, Trefids?
Yeah, and it's funny how the Danes were all treacherous, but then as they became Christian, you know, later under Knut the Great, suddenly they have this great boom in society, you know, just like the Saxons prior who were treacherous. Once they become Christian, it all changes. But yeah, what you said is exactly why, you know, all these non-European countries really struggle to build civilizations without the help of aid, because they won't honor their, you know, agreements, you know, with each other, like that they can't, you know, raise a farm and then start selling, because they'll all like con each other. Or if the farmer goes away, they'll come and steal his stuff or his wife. And that's why these countries really struggle, right? Because say China and Africa are never going to come to a trade agreement and honor their trade, right? They'll always backstab each other, or just, you know, if someone forwards the funds and says, okay, you're going to do a year's work for me, they'll just disappear with the money, right? You just know it instinctively. And that's why in white nations, we need this. You have to honor your agreements. And, you know, all throughout the day, you get a job and you turn up at time, you expect to be paid, right? You don't expect the company to just disappear and you just to be left with nothing, right? That you have to have this kind of agreement and honoring of those agreements, not necessarily contracts, but, you know, honoring your word, right? What you said.
Yeah, it's an essential part of civilization. I mean, it goes back before Christianity. I think Mithras, he was the god of laws and contracts, I think, and the shaking of the hand goes back to Mithras, this Persian aspect of divinity. So you would shake hands on an oath and on a promise for a contract, and you would keep that. You can see that everything that we built was all based on this idea of keeping your oath and keeping your contracts. But then as you said, when the Israelites lost their country and they were put in Assyria, and then they came into Europe as the Scythians and originally as the Cimmerians, they lost all of that. So the Scythians that became the Saxons and that became the Danes, they'd obviously lost all the trappings of civilization and reverted back to pre-civilizational times, I think, where they won't keep in their oaths. But then once Christianity was given to them, that brought things back down to the level that it should be at, or raised things up, I should say, rather, to the level that they should be at. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Not too much to add, really. I guess, no, to be honest, I have nothing that I can add to what's been said already. So.
Well, that's all right. Asser represents Alfred as a Solomonic judge, painstaking in his own judicial investigations and critical of royal officials who rendered unjust or unwise judgments. Although Asser never mentions Alfred's law code, he does say that Alfred insisted that his judges be literate so that they could apply themselves to the pursuit of wisdom, and the failure to comply with this royal order was to be punished by loss of office. So he insisted that all the judges learn to read. And if they couldn't read, then they could lose their office. I think we might have a look at some more of the details of that in the next episode. We're going to have a look at what Alfred was like in the court and with the judges. Any final thoughts on today before we finish, Truefitz?
Yeah, it just shows you that Alfred took it all seriously. He didn't not care about his people. And as we'll see later with his descendants, Edward, and I believe it's Ethelred. I have to always forget these names. You know, they're all so common. You see that it lasted. His son had a great reign, and then his grandson had a great reign. And this is all likely because Alfred instituted all this structure that really helped keeping the kingdom going and keeping it a moral civilization, right? It has an effect for a few generations at least, right?
Yeah, and we're going to have a good look at the Welsh laws as well, the laws of Hwelda, which I think were 100 or a couple of hundred years later. And we're going to look in detail at those as well when we finally get to them. Patriarch, any final thoughts on today? Anything you want to bring up before we finish?
Yeah, I think it's a great insight, really, to see the early workings of how Christianity has been kind of instilled or was instilled by King, especially by King Alfred. Cemented it, and kind of brought the God's laws to this is at the root of societal level. And I think one thing he represents is the notion of, to take the Lord's name, to take God's name in vain, or to take the Lord's name in vain, is essentially you're taking the name of Christ, right? You are representative of Christ, and so what Alfred is doing here is. He's essentially living by the tenets that he's obliged to, because, you know, when you're a Christian, you are purchased with a price, you're not your own. And so, for him to, claim Christian status and then not kind of follow through with that, he embodied it, didn't he? And he wanted the kindred nations to embody that. And essentially by doing so, he ensured that they didn't take God's name in vain.
He set an example that all these other kings should follow. He's basically trying to do his absolute best as a king. And he understands that, you know, what a king should do. And his people were very pleased to have him as king. As we see, you know, these other kindred nations wanted to have him as king as well, because he was so good. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Truefitz.
Thanks for having me, as always, Sven.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thanks, Sven.
And thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more patriotic history for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.